Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, December 3rd. I'm your reader, Jim Hill. Well, first let's have a look at the weather for Eastern Iowa. Today in the Cedar Rapids, Iowa City area, it will be partly cloudy and windy. The wind from the west at 15 to 25 miles per hour. We'll have a high of 29 and a low of 18. Tomorrow, Sunday, partly cloudy and wind from the southwest at 5 to 15 miles per hour. We'll have a high of 42 and a low of 23. And then on Monday, isolated rain and snow, wind from the west at 10 to 20 miles per hour. We'll have a high of 43 and a low of 20. On Tuesday, partly cloudy, the wind from the east at 5 to 15 miles per hour. We'll have a high of 35 and a low of 18. The normal high for this day is 38, the normal low, 21. The record high was 68 in 2012. The record low was minus 10 in 1940. The sun will set tonight at 4:36. It will rise tomorrow at 7:18. We have a little weather story today, this one from meteorologist Corey Thompson. Our warming winters. While the monthly outlook for December from the Climate Prediction Center shows below normal temperatures are somewhat favored this month, the longer-term picture shows that winters continue to warm in Iowa. In Cedar Rapids, in particular, our average temperature for the months of December, January, and February has increased by about 2.8 degrees since 1970. Obviously, there have been year-to-year variations, but the overall trend line is clear. 8 more days feature warmer than average temperatures in winter. Winter is also the fastest warming season for all of Iowa. The increase in winter temperatures more than outpaces a modest decrease for summer. And again, that little weather story is from meteorologist Corey Thompson. Now I'll turn to the front page of today's Gazette for our first story. And the first story has to do with the caucuses. Dem panel ousts Iowa. Realignment meant to give more voice to people of color. And this story is by Caleb McCullough of the Gazette Lee Des Moines Bureau. Iowa's Democratic Party is on track to lose the first-in-the-nation presidential caucus status it has held for half a century. In a major realignment meant to give voice in the party to more people of color, the Democratic National Committee's Rules and Bylaws Committee voted Friday on a proposed calendar for early presidential nominating contests that will remove Iowa as an early state in the party's nominating calendar. The states making up the new early window for 2024, holding Democratic primaries before the first Tuesday in March, would consist of South Carolina, New Hampshire, Nevada, Georgia, and Michigan. The proposal will need to be approved by the full Democratic National Committee, but it is expected to easily pass. States not selected as early states by the party are required to hold their primary or caucus for the 2024 presidential election on or after the first Tuesday in March. In the 2020 presidential election, the early states were Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina. Republicans, on the other hand, already have agreed to a nominating calendar that keeps Iowa's first-in-the-nation status for GOP presidential candidates. The change sets up a showdown between the Iowa Democratic Party and the National Democrats as state Democrats navigate complying with being booted from the early window while following state law, which requires both major parties to hold a caucus before any other state's nominating contest. Iowa Democratic Party Chair Ross Wilburn said in a statement Thursday, the state party would adhere to Iowa's law when it submits its delegate selection plan to the Rules Committee early next year. Quote, Iowa does not have the luxury of conducting a state-run primary, nor are Iowa Republicans likely to support legislation that would establish one, he said. Our state law requires us to hold a caucus before the last Tuesday in February and before any other contest. Caucuses in Iowa serve two purposes in presidential election years. Caucus goers express their preference for president, which results in candidates' share of state delegates to the National Party Convention. Separately, party members elect delegates to the 99 county conventions and set priorities for the party's platform. What that means for Iowa's presidential selection process remains to be seen. If Iowa holds its caucuses earlier than the DNC allows and uses them to select delegates to the national convention, rules passed Friday dictate the state's will lose half its delegates to the national convention, and the DNC can take a vote to bar all the delegates. Alternatively, Iowa Democrats could choose to hold two separate processes, a party organizing caucus and a separate presidential selection contest. Quote, they still have to have a caucus. Iowa's law still says they have to have a caucus where they would probably do the party activities, said Tim Hagel, a professor of political science at the University of Iowa. But they still have to prepare and say when they are going to have some sort of presidential preference poll, or whatever they're going to have. In its bid to remain in the early nominating window, the Iowa Democratic Party proposed an overhaul of the caucuses that would allow Democrats to express their preference for president by mail or in person ahead of the precinct caucuses. Under that proposal, on the night of the caucuses, Democrats would announce the results of the early vote and conduct the regular party organizing business of the caucuses. The new party calendar is designed to emphasize the diversity of the Democratic Party, putting more people of color into the early primary window. In a letter to the committee Thursday, President Joe Biden said black voters had been relegated to the later parts of the presidential nominating process and not given a chance to vote on the whole field of candidates. Quote, for decades, black voters in particular have been the backbone of the Democratic Party, but have been pushed to the back of the early primary contest, he wrote. We rely on these voters in elections, but have not recognized their importance in our nominating calendar. Biden has said he intends to run for election in 2024. And if he does, he is not likely to face a competitive primary challenge. The current early nominating calendar, with Iowa and New Hampshire leading, has been criticized for years for lacking diversity. Iowa is about 85% white, while New Hampshire is more than 90% white. Iowa's 2020 Democratic caucuses, in which administrative issues and a malfunctioning app led to a long delay in results, also invigorated calls to rework the process. Donna Brazil, a political strategist on the committee from Louisiana, said during the meeting, the new calendar opens up the process to more black voices in the party. She said, "I'm so proud that we're going to hear from more voices. Voices of those who simply yearn to be heard, to be seen. When I was born, this party did not see me." Proponents of keeping Iowa as an early state, however, said the proposed calendar ignores Middle America and rural states. Scott Brennan, an Iowan who sits on the Rules Committee, said during the meeting Friday in Washington, "The proposed plan includes no early states in the central and mountain time zones." He said, quote, "Small rural states like Iowa must have a voice in our presidential nominating process. Democrats cannot forget about entire groups of voters in the heart of the Midwest without doing significant damage to our party for a generation." Republicans in Iowa, who have been strong proponents of the state keeping its prized spot in the Democratic calendar, derided the proposed calendar. Quote, "Democrats have abandoned rural America and denied everyday Iowans a voice in the presidential nominating process," Governor Kim Reynolds said in a statement. "It's disappointing that there wasn't much of a debate, but that's what happens when a ruling elite gives orders from the top down. Make no mistake, Iowa Republicans will continue to protect this time-honored tradition." U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley said in a statement the proposal was a, quote, "grave mistake and would erase the voices of Middle America." Iowa GOP Chair Jeff Kaufman, who led the Republican committee to set its nominating calendar, called the vote an unserious alternative from an unserious president. The DNC and Joe Biden have just kicked off utter chaos. "This is just a recommendation, and the fight is not over," he said in a statement. All right, let's see what else we have here. Also on the front page, we have this story. Recount affirms victory in House race. Democrat won by 300 votes, but with five votes swing to rival. And this story is by Tom Barton of the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. The outcome remains the same, and the results change a little in a recount of a close Linn County State House race. Democrat Elizabeth Wilson won by 300 votes following a four-day machine recount that concluded Friday of ballots cast in the Iowa House District 73 race, a five-vote swing from the unofficial results reported in the early morning hours following the November 8th election. A bipartisan three-member board began recounting just shy. A bipartisan three-member board began recounting just shy of 45,000 ballots Tuesday in one of three legislative races that were being recounted statewide this week, where Democrats won, according to unofficial results. Republican Susie Weinacht, a former Cedar Rapids City Council member, asked for a recount in the District 73 race, where she trailed Wilson, a former Linn Mar School Board member, by 305 votes for an open seat, according to unofficial results. After reviewing ballots separated out by the machine as ineligible votes due to markings or other problems for voter intent, and after challenges by James Conklin of Marion, a former chair of the Linn County Republican Party Central Committee, who was appointed by Weinacht, and concessions made by Linda Langston, a former Linn County supervisor appointed by Wilson, Weinacht picked up five additional votes. In one case, a voter selected Weinacht, but also left a mark in the oval for a write-in candidate, which the machine rejected as an overvote. In another, a voter filled in the oval for Wilson, but when uploading the overseas ballot, it inadvertently cut off a portion of the ballot listing Weinach as a candidate. In that situation, Conklin argued, the voter could have voted for Weinach as well, in which case it would be rejected as overvote, which Langston conceded. Quote, these were Scrivener's errors decided in the recount room that could have gone either way, Langston said. I was happy to be a part of this painful process because it demonstrated that the process works. Are you going to have occasional human errors? Absolutely. What human process are we ever involved in that you don't have those migrations one way or the other? But it pretty much affirmed what happened on Election Day. I think Wilson echoed the sentiment. Quote, I think it reinforces the fact that we have a great system and checks and balances in place and can be assured this was a fair and accurate election, which the recount proved. Wilson said, I'm not surprised, but it should spread confidence. Wilson said she is ready to move forward in her official capacity and eager to hear from constituents and know what their priorities are, so I can represent them in the best possible way. She also thanked the volunteer three-member recount board. Weinach did not respond to a message seeking comment Friday afternoon after the recount was finished. Because the race's margin was more than 1% of the total number of votes counted, Weinach paid a $150 bond to the Iowa Secretary of State's office. The bond, however, does not cover the cost of county staff time to run tabulators and scanners, oversee the security of the ballots, and otherwise facilitate the recount. That cost, which Matt Warfield, Linn County Deputy Commissioner of Elections, estimated to be less than $1,000, will be picked up by the county. Conklin said she did not expect to find enough votes to overturn the results, but said a recount was needed to provide confidence in the race results and expose process deviations. After mistakes were made by the Linn County Auditor's Office on Election Day. Those included erroneously leaving an election for county supervisor off the ballot in one precinct, and an error since corrected reporting early vote counts. Conklin said he plans to issue a paper about his observations, saying the Auditor's Office suffers from incompetence and inexperience. He noted there was a discrepancy of 9 fewer ballots between the numbers of absentee ballots scanned on election night versus the number of ballots scanned during the recount. Quote, we don't have enough information to know if they're missing or if there was an additional count, Warfield said. We just don't have any corroborating information. All we know is there is a difference in the absentee ballots scanned on election night versus how many we scanned in this process by a total of 9. Conklin said he saw no evidence that anybody is doing anything wrong, but there needs to be better types of training. Warfield said the recount was beneficial in educating candidates about the recount process and identifying areas to improve our processes as well, not just on Election Day, but in communicating with the public and concerned citizens leading up to the election as well. He said, quote, because the biggest uphill struggle I have is restoring, basically, our customer confidence in the process. And with all of the misinformation that's floating around out there, I would classify it as an impossible order, but I think it's one that has to be approached. The state's canvas board, a collection of statewide office holders that includes the governor and Iowa Secretary of State, met Thursday to certify the results of the November 8th elections in Iowa. Because recounts are being conducted in three counties, Lynn Scott and Cerro Gordo, the board will have to meet again to certify those results. And with that, I will pause for a second and have a sip of coffee. Well, we have from the Iowa Today page this story on the bird flu outbreak. 40,000 turkeys killed after Buena Vista bird flu outbreak. And the story is by Aaron Jordan of the Gazette. Iowa officials Friday confirmed another case of bird flu, this time in a commercial turkey flock in Buena Vista County. The flock of 40,000 turkeys was euthanized after the confirmation of the virus, the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship reported. It's the 24th case reported in Iowa this year, and the fifth since October, with the second round likely connected to the fall migration of wild birds. This makes the fifth case reported in Buena Vista County so far this year. Commercial and backyard flock owners should try to prevent contact between their birds and wild birds, such as geese or ducks. While most infected wild birds don't have symptoms, the virus often is fatal for domestic bird populations, such as chickens and turkeys. The highly contagious virus can spread through droppings or in the nasal discharge of an infected bird, which can contaminate soil or dust. If flock owners suspect bird flu, which can cause poultry to be lethargic, have difficulty breathing, or have reduced egg production, producers should contact their veterinarian. I've turned to the Insight page of the Gazette, where first up we have this Gazette editorial. Pass County Pipeline Rules. Lynn County's Board of Supervisors is considering an ordinance next week that would regulate pipelines carrying hazardous materials, including sequestered carbon, across the county. We think the ordinance would be in the best interests of county residents and support its passage. Colorado-based Wolf Carbon Systems is planning a pipeline carrying compressed CO2 from ADM plants in Cedar Rapids and Clinton to an underground sequestration site in Illinois. The Wolf Pipeline would cross Lynn County. The ordinance would seek to set safe setbacks between the pipeline and public facilities such as schools, hospitals, and parks, as well as residences. The local ordinance would fill a regulatory gap created by still unfinished federal rules. In May, the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration announced it would update its carbon pipeline regulations in the wake of a pipeline rupture in Sartaria, Mississippi, that hospitalized 45 people. CO2 is an asphyxiant that, in high concentrations, can cause illness and death. This week, 30 groups sent a letter to PHMSA asking that it recommend states hold off on permitting new carbon pipelines until the federal rulemaking process is completed. Quote, it would be ludicrous to allow pipeline corporations eager to cash in on a gold rush of federal subsidies to run roughshod over communities while the federal government still is evaluating the explicit dangers of those proposals, said Jim Walsh, policy director for Food and Water Watch, one of the groups supporting the letter. We agree. In the meantime, we welcome Lynn County's effort to put some safety measures in place. Similar efforts in Shelby and Story counties have prompted federal lawsuits by another pipeline company, Summit Carbon Solutions. The same may occur with regard to Linn County's ordinance, but we think it's the supervisor's role to act in the public interest, not worry about a potential clash with pipeline interests. And with billions of new federal subsidies now available thanks to actions by Congress and the Biden administration, Wolf may not be the only pipeline project in Linn County's future. It's best to be prepared by protecting Linn County residents now. And again, that is the Gazette's editorial. Now I'll drop down the page a bit for community letters. And today we have just one letter, this from Gretchen Ree Robinson of Mount Vernon. Deesha's article makes unseen seen. Your front page Thanksgiving story, Living on the Streets, leaves me struggling to write. The large color photo of Johnny Ray Delgado and Mary Sand is beautiful and heartbreaking. I thank Delgado and Sand for their willingness to be the visual representation of the unsheltered, the homeless, people sleeping on the streets on a nightly basis. Delgado and Sand are living in a tent in a little-known village of homeless people in Cedar Rapids. Elijah Deesha's writes to make homeless people real, and their front page presence brings them inside our homes. Yes, there are statistics and numbers of people unhoused counted by homeless outreach workers whose jobs are made evident in the article too. The contrast between post-Thanksgiving, Small Business Saturday, Frenzy, and other shopping events, and Delgado and Sand living in a tent is vibrantly clear to me. My Thanksgiving meal, three different pies, shamed me, because as I sat down to eat, I imagined the number we don't like to discuss, the people living in the homeless encampment in Cedar Rapids, the people Deesha's got to know in order to write his story. This front page story is also in contrast to a commonly used phrase, I love my country. I hope that love extends to Delgado and Sand. Saying I love my country is easy. Is it also meaningless? And again, that letter is from Gretchen Ree Robinson of Mount Vernon. Okay, let's see what else we have here. Well, we have this a column on the inside page by Patrick Muller. This is a guest column by Patrick Muller. Bon Accord as New Year approaches. I like hoodies. They are comfortable, warm, and often celebrate an enterprise, a team, or a place. I especially like the place ones. My first place hoodie was Earlham, Bell Plain, West Liberty, and Lone Tree. Let me start that again so it comes out right. My first place hoodie was Earlham. Bell Plain, West Liberty, and Lone Tree soon joined my closet. Waukon, Bellevue, and Montezuma may be next on my list. I'm just getting started. The other day, I bought a Coralville hoodie. In 2023, Coralville will celebrate 150 years. I was born in Washington and grew up in Iowa City. But for a short stint, only a few months, I think, my young parents and my older siblings lived in Coralville before settling a bit southeast of the old capital. Later on, I went to Northwest Junior High. I don't remember attending the drive-through movie theater on Highway 6, but I'm sure my siblings did. Long before Coralville was known for shopping at Coral Ridge Mall and Iowa River Landing, long before Hayden Fry Way and Heartlander Pucks flying across the ice, there were tasty, cheap, and accessible dining options on the Strip. As a kid, I must have eaten more in Coralville than in Iowa City. There was a green pepper, a purple cow, and carousel. There was King's, where you sat in booths and ordered by phone. And on First Avenue, way out by the interstate, there was the comfort food of Meyer's truck stop. My nourishment and my education, to some extent, were procured in Coralville. I belong to Coralville. I am happy to celebrate it. Most threads of my family came to the United States and Iowa decades before Coralville was born. They came from places I can identify: Scotland, Belgium, France, Germany, Ireland, Sweden. A DNA analysis adds relatives from Syria, Lebanon, or Jordan, and from the Baltics. Family lore and a scribbling, not entirely to be trusted, in a Bible say I am fractionally Lenape. That's spelled L-E-N-A-P-E. My Iowa ancestors settled in Wheatland, Andrew, Charlotte, Correctionville, Riverside, Wellman, and Parnell. Their descendants have spread the diasporic seep to Cedar Rapids, Marshalltown, Atkins, Hills, North Liberty, Melbourne, Wiltshire, and Gasp, Illinois. Why am I sharing my geographical and municipal reminiscences? I really have no idea, except it is a big, bright world, and a brand new year is approaching. Boundaries, categories, and other delineations have their uses, but they are sometimes at their best when they are traversed. Down the street, across town, even a few miles further along the highway, there are people to meet, things to do, experiences to have. In Iowa, you can meander from Ainsworth to Zwingle. You can do it with agency, confidence, or defiance. Your adventure will be fertile and nourished with gravity and independence. You may find yourself in a lost nation, but also in Jamaica, Panama, Persia, and Westphalia. You will never find yourself at a last chance to be curious. Exploration and interaction may become your avocation. I'll stop with the itinerant humor here. Yet, Ghosted Bonacord Good Agreement is just a few blocks from my home. Standing there in a field now crusted with snow and dotted with cut corn stalks, let me wish you a happy new year. And again, this guest call is by Patrick Muller, who lives in Hills. Pause for another sip of coffee. You're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for on Iris. Let me start that again. You're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, December 3rd, on Iris, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now, let's turn to today's obituaries. First, we have the short notices. From Cedar Rapids, Marcella D. Ritter, 75, formerly of Belle Plaine, died Wednesday, November 30th. Arrangements are with the Hrabek Newhouse Funeral Service. From Clarence, Wilbert F. Wendt, 85, died Friday, December 2nd. Arrangements are with the Chapman Funeral Home of Clarence. From Mitchellville, Shirley D. Sanache, that's spelled S-A-N-A-C-H-E, 75, formerly of Tama, died Thursday, December 1st. Arrangements are with the Cruz Phillips Funeral Home of Tama, Toledo. From Monticello, Robert Holmes, 78, died Friday, December 2nd. Arrangements are with the Goetsch Funeral Home of Monticello. From Irvine, Janet Leverington, 87, died Friday, December 2nd. Arrangements are with the Jameson Schmitz Funeral Home of Irvine. From Waukon, Janet N. Bechtel, 80, died Wednesday, November 30th. Arrangements are with the Martin Grau Funeral Home in Waukon. Also, we have here under the short notices, Emma Adams, 82, of Hamilton, Illinois, died Wednesday, November 30th. The arrangements are with the Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Cedar Rapids. Now we have the longer notices from Cedar Rapids. Courtney Renee Bartlett, 33, of Cedar Rapids, died on Tuesday, November 29th. A visitation will be held from 9 to 11 a.m. Saturday, December 10th, at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. A memorial service will follow at 11 a.m. Saturday at the funeral home. From Manchester, David Francis Lubbin, 69, of Manchester, passed away on Thursday, December 1st, at the Monticello Nursing and Rehabilitation Center in Monticello after a courageous battle with Parkinson's disease. His funeral service will be at 11 a.m. Tuesday, December 6th, at Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Manchester, with Pastor Mike Jackson officiating. Visitation will be from 9 to 11 a.m. Tuesday, December 6th, at the same funeral home, Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Manchester. From Iowa City, Dr. Richard, also known as Rick Earl Vanscoy, spelled V-A-N-S-C-O-Y, 66, of Iowa City, former teacher and coach in schools in central Iowa, died November 22nd in Iowa City, surrounded by his family, while Amazing Grace played softly. A celebration of life services will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, December 9th, at the Gay and Chia Funeral Home in Iowa City. We will have a speaker at 5 p.m., then a time for open sharing. Okay. From Dyersville, Elvira A. Kroger, 92, of Dyersville, passed away Thursday, December 1st, at her home, surrounded by love. Visitation will be held from 2 to 6 p.m. Sunday, December 4th, at Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville. Visitation will continue at the funeral home from 9 to 10 a.m. Monday before funeral mass. A mass of Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. Monday, December 5th, at St. Francis Xavier Basilica in Dyersville, with burial in the church cemetery. The Reverend Gabriel Mensa will officiate. Okay. From Iowa City, Michael R. Slezak passed away at home on November 28th in Iowa City, surrounded by his family, after living with pancreatic cancer for the past year. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions in Mike's memory are suggested to the National Park Foundation or to Urban Boat Builders in St. Paul, Minnesota. And finally, from Cedar Rapids, Methel R. Daniel, 84, of Cedar Rapids, died Thursday, December 1st. No funeral services will be held at this time. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. And now I will pause for a sip of coffee and then turn to the sports page of the Gazette, where we have this story under the headlines, 2022 Gazette Area Volleyball Player and Coach of the Year. Liberty's Hartman, Kelly, best of best. Area's Player, Coach of the Year, led Lightning to Class 5A State Championship. And this story is by Jeff Linder of the Gazette. Allie Kelly will be the first to tell you she was the beneficiary of positive circumstances. Quote, former coach Randy Dolson built a good foundation here. We all know that, Kelly said. Experienced, talented, committed players, that doesn't hurt either. And this fall, it all came together. Iowa City Liberty won 17 of its final 18 matches to claim the Class 5A State Volleyball Championship, the school's first team title in any sport. As a result, the Lightning sweep the top awards on the Gazette's 2022 All-Area Team. Four-year starter Cassidy Hartman is the Player of the Year, and Kelly, in her first year as the Bolts' sole head coach, is the Coach of the Year. A 6'1" outside hitter headed to the University of Northern Iowa, Hartman is a three-time elite All-State pick. State tournament appearances capped by the title in November in Coralville. Quote, she's definitely the best player Liberty has ever seen, Kelly said. The accolades speak for themselves. She was a complete player when she came in on day one. She wasn't scared of the upperclassmen. She came in ready to make her mark, and she certainly has done that. This season, Hartman averaged 4.98 kills and 3.97 digs per set. She concluded her career with 1,542 kills and 1,368 digs. She was erratic at times in the first two rounds of the state tournament, but picked it up in the finals, recording 26 kills and 22 digs in a four-set win over Pleasant Valley. Quote, if I'm struggling with a skill, I have something else I can go to regain confidence, Hartman said before the state tournament. If I'm struggling with my hitting, I can go to the back row and work on my passing. That makes all of my skills better. Kelly, 29, was an all-stater herself as Allie Hutchinson at Cedar Rapids Kennedy from... Let me start that again. Kelly, 29, was an all-stater herself at Allie Hutchinson at Cedar Rapids Kennedy, from which she graduated in 2012. She played a season at Northern Colorado before finishing her education at Iowa State. A high school math teacher, she spent a year at Norwalk before joining Dolson's staff when Liberty opened in 2017. She was elevated to head coach in 2021, then took over when Dolson retired after last season. Quote, We brought veteran coach Scott Sanders aboard this year as an assistant, and he brought a lot of experience I certainly needed to help me, Kelly said. Liberty, 33-8, started the season ranked number one, but took some hits against elite competition early in the season. Kelly said, quote, I think back to our first state appearance in 2019. We got there, we hadn't had any adversity, and we didn't know how to handle it. Our tough schedule really helped us this year. Liberty beat Urbandale, Ankeny, Centennial, and Pleasant Valley at state, all in four sets. Kelly is 67-13 in two seasons. She said, quote, every coach has a personality. I'm excitable. I think I learned to have more composure this year. I was going to give my season to these girls. The all-area squad consists of 12 players, and Hartman is among four who earned elite all-state recognition by the Iowa Girls Coaches Association. Marion's Avery Van Hook, Western Dubuque's Ella Meyer, and Mount Vernon's Madeline Miller were elite picks. Van Hook and Miller were state players of the year in 4A and 3A, respectively. The rest of the team consists of Liberty's Shelby Kim, Libby Fandel, a 4A state champion Cedar Rapids, Xavier, Bliss Beck of Clear Creek Amana, Aubrey Gates of Union Community, Nia Howard of Springville, Libby Lansing of Western Dubuque, Chloe Meester of Mount Vernon, and Olivia Schulte of West Delaware. Okay. All right, I will pause for another sip of coffee. All right. Well, let's see what else we have here. Well, we have this on the living page of the Gazette. And this article that looks very interesting. It appears under a big illustration of a toy house lit up with lights. The title of the article is Bright Ideas. Mount Pleasant Festival of Lights celebrates 10 years. And the story is by Elijah Decius of the Gazette. Mount Pleasant, one of Southeast Iowa's largest holiday light events, is getting even bigger as it celebrates its 10th year of making things merry and bright at the Midwest Old Threshers Campground. Now, with 165 light displays, there's extra emphasis on the bright at the light show, billed online as Southeast Iowa's largest holiday drive-through park. In just 10 years since its first show in 2013, the annual month-long celebration has grown from 60 displays over 1 mile to its current number over a mile and a half of pavement throughout the campground. Soon, they have plans to expand. The idea started when Melinda Huizinga, a founding organizer of the Festival of Lights, saw the campground dark one winter after moving to Mount Pleasant. Quote, "We saw this campground dark and we were used to light shows in Des Moines. It seemed like a logical place to use that real estate," she said. "You have all this real estate, it may as well be used." With experience sponsoring similar events in the Des Moines area as business owners and working with light vendors, they started first with the annual Midwest Haunted Rails and Haunted House on the campground around Halloween, a Christmas display for the largest holiday of the year seemed like the next logical step. 10 years later, it's a tradition that has brought families together and showed its value, particularly through the pandemic. During the first year of the pandemic, volunteers saw 9,000 cars go through. Last year's attendance was 7,000, still higher than the average of 5,000 before the pandemic, and is expected to remain steady this year. Last year's attendance boasted cars from 73 counties and 35 states. Quote, "Most of us volunteers remember going to Yarmouth, where two farmers would light up their whole farmyard. That became a family tradition," said Huizinga. "We wanted to carry that on and give families something they could do together." Now the penchant for recreating nostalgic memories has turned into a $100,000 operation with 210 sponsors and too many volunteers to count by memory. With a mix of leased and owned lights, the collection grows each year with new displays to keep it fresh. Annual favorites like the Toy House, its largest and most impressive display, are joined by dozens of new displays this year. One of the most vibrant new attractions this year is the RBG Tunnel, an LED-lit computer-controlled tunnel that makes a show with endless configurations of Christmas colors. Nearby, similar trees, lights dance in sync with music. Quote, "We've been told it might become a traffic jam because people like to sit there and enjoy the whole routine," said Huizinga. "We'll see how it goes because it is fascinating to watch." Through the rest of the course, music over the air from KILG complements the in-car dimension experience. New lights lining the pavement of the 1.5-mile path this year will help guide drivers too. If you prefer a more old-fashioned mode of transportation, horse and wagon rides are back by popular demand. To buy tickets in advance, go to oldthreshers.org Festival of Lights. Other new displays include a new archway Festival of Lights, Fairyland, and a faith-based area where a trumpeting angel ushers visitors into a nativity scene. Tradition and novelty collide to offer variety for every viewer. From the new 12 Days of Christmas to the Pirates section, where children's eyes can twinkle watching a shooting cannonball or sword fight in motion. The Dickens Snow Village now adorns the walls of Santa's heated house, where children and parents can line up to get photos with Santa on his plush velvet chair next to the cozy fireplace. The Avenue of Honor, another new display this year, allows sponsors to name a lit symbol in honor of anyone they'd like to recognize. Stars will be named in memory of loved ones, gingerbread in honor of children, flags in honor of those who have served in the past or present, and evergreen trees after community members like volunteers, teachers, nurses, or anyone recognized for their contribution to the community. Names of each person honored are published in a brochure, distributed to attendees, and the display is expected to grow in coming years with a waiting list already in place for next year. Well, it's a nice article. Well, let's see what else we have here. Well, we have also on the living page here, we have things to do today. And here are just a sampling of them. Under Community, Christmas Open House. Come check out the Cedar Rapids Area Genealogy Library that is located in the lower level of the Masonic Library. Parking is available in the rear, enter through the back door. And that will be from 1 to 3 p.m. today at the Cedar Rapids Area Genealogy Library, 813 First Avenue Southeast in Cedar Rapids, and there's no charge for that. Under Faith and Values, Prairie Chapel Live Nativity. This has been a church annual tradition for more than 30 years. As you turn off Highway 13, follow the luminaries a half mile to the church. Slowly drive through or park and walk around or visit anything. Let me start that again. Slowly drive through or park and walk around to visit everything. Cookies are provided, and that will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Today at the Prairie Chapel United Methodist Church, 1817 Prairie Chapel Road in Marion. And there's no charge for that. Under Health and Fitness, Reindeer Run. Bring your holiday cheer as you run, walk, prance your way through a 3-mile fun run in Hiawatha. And that will be at 9 a.m. at Fay M. Clark Park, 1200 North 18th Avenue in Hiawatha. And the charge for that, $25 to $30. Under Fundraiser, Nature's Noel. Shop the Indian Creek Nature Center's annual holiday fundraiser, featuring fresh green decor, artisan gifts, frozen soups, appetizers, baked goods, and more. And that will be from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Indian Creek Nature Center Barn, 5300 Otis Road, Southeast in Cedar Rapids, and there's no charge for that. And finally here, under Holiday, Cedar Rapids Nativity Celebration. Come see the Armstrong-Smulikoff Nativity, a tradition for 50 years, as well as hundreds of beautiful and unique nativity sets on display. Enjoy children's activities and live music. And that will be from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. today at the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, 4150 Blue Jay Drive in Cedar Rapids. And there's no charge for that, but bring a canned food item to be donated to local food banks. All right. And let's see, what else do we have here? We cannot end this session without reading the Dear Abby column. Elderly couple, ruffled feathers. Dear Abby, 2.5 years ago, we lost my dad, who was 94. He and mom had been married 72 years. She entered assisted living right before COVID set in. We made it through that, and her facility has opened back up. Mom has met and befriended a similarly aged widower. They eat together, walk, attend activities, and enjoy sitting and talking together every day. They reach for one another's hands to hold while talking about their departed spouses, and are a source of great comfort for each other. Mom has recently found out that this man's daughters are upset about their friendship, and she feels badly about it. She says she would never do anything to hurt him. I've told her she needs to give his daughters time to wrap their minds around their friendship. What can I do to help the daughters build trust in this situation? And this letter is signed, Delicate Situation in Arkansas. Dear Delicate Situation, your mother is not the first romance to blossom in a situation like this, and it won't be the last. What has happened is a blessing, and I hope the man's daughters will come to regard it as one. Reaching out to them isn't a bad idea, if you think it may calm the situation, and you can do it without making them more defensive. The older folks have a right to be happy in the remaining years. If there is a religious advisor connected to the assisted living facility, he or she might be able to help. And pardon me, and that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, December 3rd. I'm your reader, Jim Hill. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you for listening.